From KTOO, I'm Katie Anastas with a look at local and statewide news. The salmon season in southeast Alaska is wrapping up. The big takeaway so far? The fish were there, but the market wasn't. Chum and pink runs were very strong, but many processors slashed prices and stopped buying fish early. They blamed a global glut of salmon. Beau Meredith has been working with salmon in southeast for nearly 25 years, first as a commercial fisherman, and then as an area management biologist for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. He's based out of Ketchikan. He spoke with Coast Alaska's Angela Denning about what state managers have been seeing with this year's salmon runs, starting with king salmon.
Another year of mixed returns. Assessment is ongoing. We, right now, out of the 11 monitored southeast Chinook stocks, 6 have made goal, 3 have missed goal, and 2 are as yet to be determined. And those 2 to be determined stocks are the Taku and Stikine. And that will be finalized here in another couple of weeks when they're big long systems and they should have picked their time given where they're going and then we enumerate throughout September into early October.
Okay. And how did sockeyes in southeast do this year in terms of their returns to the water systems?
Generally, it was good. We had a couple stocks in southern southeast that did not perform well, Houston sockeye being first and foremost on my mind. But generally, the Chilcat, Chilcoot, and Haynes, the Taku out of Juneau, and the Stikine River, which are the big driver sockeye systems in the region, did well. They were at or above their preseason forecast, and all 4 of them, I should say, met the lower end of their escapement goals. And then you, of course, have some silver linings with Readout Lake sockeye on the outside of Baranoff that had its highest sockeye return ever. It had liberalized, sport, personal use, subsistence, commercial fishing opportunities, and it still achieved its record escapement.
Now, essentially, it seems like the pinks and chum runs, the fish were there, it's just the market wasn't.
Well, the chums were a little different, and that's primarily hatchery-driven chums. And the chum return for Southeast in general was exceptionally strong. I think overall we went into the season with the hatchery forecast of 9 million. Our chum harvest right now is over 13 million, and that's probably going to creep up as we get fish tickets finalized. And that was the chum return, peaks in, third, fourth week in July. So at that point in the season, the price was maintaining at the 50 and 60 cent level. It's still a big drop from last year's price of 115, but those fish still had value early on in the season when the majority of the chum returns came back. I think the price ended up dropping on August 3rd or 4th, when again, you're past the peak for those summer chum returns. The pinks really start ramping up, that third, fourth week in July, and at the time when the chums are starting to ramp down, but both of them overall ended up extremely strong throughout the region.
And then moving on to cohos, we're in September, they're still running, but what can you tell us about them?
Coho indicators look really good. We've had, extended fishing time of District 1 of District 11. District 11 is targeting the primarily Taku coho run. The power troll CPE for coho on the outside waters is the highest it's ever been, I believe. It's certainly well above the 20-year average. And you're going to see at some point today a troll extension for coho through the end of the month, which, typically happens on a big coho abundance year. But like you said, it's early and we don't start enumerating coho in the Ketchikan area until early October. The Taku has a pretty good assessment project and the fish wheels and the numbers through the Taku are doing extremely well right now. And I think you'll see continual opportunity for the inside gillnet fisheries through the end of the month, maybe even into early October. And, to be determined on what the final run size will be, but it's looking very good right now. And again, to see the numbers like we're seeing for the troll CPE on the outside waters is interesting because it's a little bit late, suggesting the coho run might be a little bit later as well.
All right. Well, thanks so much for taking us through species by species. Do you have any other takeaways from this season that you could share?
Every season is unique and different, and this one was certainly no exception.
Beau Meredith is an area management biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. He was speaking with Coast Alaska's Angela Denning. 10 people officially became United States citizens this week in Juneau. On Wednesday, immigrants from the Philippines, Mexico, Canada, Chile, and the Netherlands took the Oath of Allegiance in front of their families and friends at a naturalization ceremony at the Robert Boutchever U.S. Courthouse. Claire Punongbayan is originally from Aklan in the Philippines. She's been in the U.S. for more than 3 years and began her citizenship process about 6 months ago. She says she's excited to be able to vote.
I'm the only one in the household that's not American citizen yet, so might as well get it to be on board with everyone.
Punongbayan's husband and his parents were there to cheer her on. Some of the new citizens have been in Juneau for decades already. Benta Myrtle Posthumus has lived in Juneau for 25 years. She first arrived as an exchange student from the Netherlands. She ended up meeting her husband and raising 4 kids. She wore an American flag scarf for the ceremony.
I realize now that this is the place I'm going to stay. My future is here. My children are here and they're staying here. So, yeah, this is the place of my future.
She said her friends were planning to throw a party to celebrate. Juneau residents who want to become U.S. citizens often have to travel to Anchorage for the official ceremony. But staff from U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services say they're making more trips to outlying communities in Alaska to host ceremonies, workshops, and other citizenship processing. A group of women in Petersburg have been getting together to quilt for nearly 4 decades. This past weekend, they brought a beloved member of their group back to town to teach classes. That reunion led to reflections on the way that quilting can stretch brains, build community, and heal. KFSK's Hannah Floor has the story.
And I kind of like this.
We're in the Holy Cross House of the Petersburg Lutheran Church, a high-ceilinged room with skylights. Unfinished quilts cover the walls. Squares stuck to fuzzy fabric so that quilters can play with their designs.
Right, I like that one too. Yeah. But this doesn't do anything.
I don't like that
anything.
At all. No. Oh, that's awful.
I love it, Chris.
Chris Kissinger can't decide what her final quilt should look like. She's been quilting for about 40 years and is used to knowing where she's going with the project. But this is improv quilting.
We're just going to change it, Chris. We're not going to throw it away.
With traditional quilting, the design is established before you start. With improv quilting, the design is built as you go. Melissa Caraway is teaching the class. She says that since the process is so different from traditional quilting, it can be kind of scary for some people.
But once you get the hang of it, it's very freeing.
Caraway lived and quilted in Petersburg for decades. Now she comes back every year to teach classes. Those classes are put on by Petersburg's Rain Country Quilters. Each year, they sew patriotic quilts for veterans in Petersburg, which they present during a Veterans Day ceremony. A few years ago, they started including high school students in the project. During the school's annual day of service, the group sets up a classroom and teaches students to sew. Rain Country quilter Sue Flint worked with a student who was making a quilt for her grandpa.
Well, he was a veteran. He didn't live in Petersburg, but they just took it down south to him. And it's an emotional thing.
Bringing quilting to high school students and others is part of the mission of the Rain Country Quilters. Flint says the group would love to help younger folks discover the craft.
Our youngest member has kids in college right now. We're mostly pretty gray-haired. We have one high school student taking a class on Saturday, and we're excited about that.
Caraway and Flint urge those who are curious not to be intimidated by the size of a full quilt. They say smaller projects like placemats or table runners are a good place to start.
Baby mm-hmm. quilts are a great idea.
Right.
Yeah.
They're small. They're mm-hmm. less intimidating.
Right.
Babies don't care. They just like them.
That's right.
Caraway says quilting is a way to connect with others in the community.
The sharing with other people, people that you didn't normally come in contact with on a daily basis, but you shared a common interest. And so it gave you much more of a feeling of belonging, which is important to everyone, I think.
She says lots of her students and customers joke that quilting is cheaper than therapy.
You do get to reflect on things and people that you care about when you're sewing. So it's a very healing process for me and for many others, I think.
Right. See, and I like the way this goes.
Chris Kissinger still hasn't settled on a final configuration for her quilt, but she says she really likes improv quilting, and that surprised her.
I'll do it again. Yeah, it was good. It's good for old brains to learn new things. So, yeah.
Members of the Rain Country Quilters plan to continue organizing yearly classes and learning new ways of doing the time-honored craft. In Petersburg, I'm Hannah Flohr.